Hello and welcome back to another Unboxed broadcast. We're excited to be with you today as we explore a very interesting topic, and it's about groupthink. We want to talk about how to recognize it, where does it stem from, and how to lead through the challenges of groupthink. So please stay with us as we unbox the power and the potential of your leadership.
I'm Dr. Robert Davis, family life educator and leadership coach. This is my co-host, R.P. Soriano. Soriano attended John Hopkins Carey Business School, worked in the financial industry, and was an international consultant before partnering with me to launch Unboxed to Lead. Me? Well, I worked for over 20 years as a senior pastor and a community organizer. Then I retired and started a leader's peer support community called Unboxed to Lead. Soriano and I have been friends since the early 90s, and with our varied experiences and expertise, we help leaders reach the next level in their leadership. So join us for the next few moments as we unbox the power and the potential of your relationships, your leadership, and your life.
All right. Welcome everyone to another Unboxed broadcast. Again, I'm here joined with Dr. Robert Davis. Hey. I just want to remind everyone to please like, share, and subscribe if you find this broadcast of any value. Before we dive into our subject and talk a little more about that, let's handle a little bit of brief housekeeping. Dr. Davis, we've got an event coming up soon, a webinar. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you so much. I was about to overtalk you. I'm so excited about it. We have a webinar that's coming up on September the 20th, and I encourage you to click the link below in the description so that you can register. The subject that we're going to be talking about is how to manage sabotage. As leaders, we often have situations where team members are fighting against us. I mean, they're going in a total opposite direction. Executive directors have boards that are not cooperating and working with them. So how do you manage sabotage within your team so that you can, in fact, reach your organizational goals and be productive? It's a webinar that you don't want to miss. Please click on the link below. It's going to be on September the 20th. That's Tuesday, September the 20th. And that's going to be at 9 a.m. Mountain Standard Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You don't want to miss it.
All right. That's wonderful. And this is what's the cost for this webinar?
Oh, man, it cost you a big freebie. That's right. It is 100% free, but seats are limited. Seats are limited, and we are making this available to organizational leaders. So you will be asked a question about your organization that you do lead when you register. It's for organizational leaders such as executive directors, C-suite officers, vice presidents, and things of that nature, because we really do want to make sure that we are benefiting those who are in positions of leadership.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. All right. So let's get on to our topic today. We're talking about groupthink, and we're talking about how that impacts the leader's decisions and experience. This is pretty much the bread and butter of what we do, right? It's understanding relationship systems, understanding why we are making the choices and the decisions that we make and what we're prone to kind of flow into or resist because of our family systems and because of the relationship systems that we operate in. So today we're talking about groupthink, and the title of the show is "We're Fighting the Pressure to Go Along in Order to Get Along." Why don't you take us through this? Help make some sense of this this whole idea of our topic today.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. You know, the reality of the matter is we are social beings. We live in the world with other human beings. The last time I did an individual count, I think I came up with about 8 billion human beings. There were a few people who weren't home when I went by to count them. But the last count I did, we were right at about 8 billion people on this planet. And we are social. So there is a tendency, and you use the term groupthink. I'm going to throw out another term. It's the same thing, but it's called the togetherness forces. And it's just as a part of our survival, we realize that we have to work together. We had to work together to hunt, We had to work together to plant. We had to work together to defend ourselves against others, as well as against the elements, as well as against you know, wild animals and things of that nature. So it became important for human beings throughout our history to find ways to come together. Now, the challenge with that is that oftentimes and too often, the positive instinct of coming together, working together, and thinking alike. So you do want everyone to think, hold on a second, you know, if you have five lions who are attacking a group of 20 humans, you want the 20 humans to come together and to all be thinking, how are we going to stop these lions from eating us? You don't want to have 21 person, you know, thinking about how they're going to pick berries, another person thinking about, you know, the mountain they want to climb next week. You kind of want that group think to be in there. So there is a survival perspective. And but that can also seep into what started off as a survival tool can also seep into areas of our life that stunt our creativity, that ultimately stunt our productivity. So as leaders, what we want to do is we want to be able to move our team so that our teams know how to think as a group, but also know how to think individually. And that is a delicate balance. I want to read something that I came across, and I have a couple of quotes from this author. Her name is Andrea Scarra, and her book is Your Mindful Compass. And this is the first quote that she has. She says, "For the human, the instinct to cooperate and the tendency to go along with coercive social pressure is also built on the same instinct about which we are totally unaware. It is difficult for us to know how we are being socially controlled and influenced to be in the service of others. It is difficult to know if we are doing or even thinking things about our own individual viewpoints, or if our thinking is simply a reflection of our deep connection to instinctive programming as a part of the group. It requires both an awareness of these instinctive forces and the ability to carefully consider one's reaction and belief in order to pull a real self out of the mire of the togetherness forces." Translated, man, the togetherness forces are often so entrenched that we have a difficult time really even knowing where the togetherness forces end and where our individuality begins. And great leaders know how to walk that thin tightrope line. You get where I'm coming from, Raphael. They know how to walk that thin tightrope line, and that's what makes great leaders authentic leaders.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a real challenge, especially the way that you're kind of presenting this, is that the programming is so strong, the cultural influences are so strong. I mean, all of these things are, and they have their reason and their purpose. But it is our programming for the most part. So how does the leader then deal with the challenge of kind of knowing where their thinking begins and the influence of others ends? So you talk about walking this tight rope. What's the key to kind of being able to learn how to do that?
Well, you know, before we get deep into it, and I think you kind of understand this as well. It is like you just said, it is a tight rope to really be able to recognize where my thinking ends or begins and the group thinking ends. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit further along. You know, when you look at it from a cultural perspective, a family perspective, there are just so many variables. There are so many forces, Raphael, that are pushing us to have to cooperate as human beings, which is so wonderful, which is so necessary. But the challenge, as I shared just a moment ago, is being able to know when it's time to think alike and when it's time to have your individuality. When is that healthy time to be me? When is that healthy time for us to be us? And I think that in this modern age, especially, society has such a difficult challenge knowing When do we need to cooperate and come together? And then when do we need to be separate? And a lot of this, you know, with the social media stuff that we see and all of this, you know, this pushback is really challenging. It makes it more challenging with the cancel culture and everything. And, you know, they try to make it seem like the cancel culture is just on one side of the street. You know, cancel culture is on both sides of the street. But it's a symbol of immaturity. And the reason it's a symbol of immaturity is because I need everyone to think like me. And I'm not able to hear individual thinking. And then I am against other groups who are using groupthink around their issues. So, for instance, I'm using groupthink about how I view abortion. But then I am angry and dogmatic toward others who are using groupthink to figure out, you know, to around their thinking about abortion. Mm-hmm. So you gotta see how crazy this whole thing is. And so I've seen in my own life, you know, where I have struggled, you know, repeatedly every single day, I guess it is, with where does groupthink end? Where does, you know, individual thinking begins? And let me say this last thing. We are a collection of everything that we have read, everything that we've seen, everything that we've heard, everything that we've experienced. And even more so, we are influenced by the current relationship system that we are making our decision in. So literally, we will make a different decision, even if it's the same issue that we're deciding around. Decision will be different when we're making that decision with our church relationship system and when we're making that with our workplace relationship system. You say, well, hold on, how is that? Again, that whole thing goes back to just the concept of the togetherness forces, the group think. In every situation that we encounter, the totality of our life, the totality of the group that we're in influences our experience. So if we take the time to think about decisions we have made, we can trace the influences that led to that decision, especially when those influences are from the togetherness forces, the group think, the herd mentality, or whatever else that you want to call it. If we can stop and say, okay, hold on. This is why I'm thinking the way I'm thinking. I'm thinking this way because this is my own individual thinking, or I'm thinking this way because of this group that I'm in, or because of the culture that I'm a part of, or because of the influence of X, Y, and Z. The clearer we can become, and this is where great thinkers come from, the clearer we can become about what is influencing our thinking, even our emotions, then the healthier and the clearer we can become about our thinking. And great leaders are great thinkers, as we've shared so many times before. And you know, one of the things, Raphael, is you have had the experience. I've done a lot of talking here. I kind of want to bring you into the hot seat. You, your work experience really puts you in two of the most heard mentality or group thinking atmospheres that a person can be in. Number one, you were a law enforcement officer, and then you worked in banking. I don't think there's any two industries where group thinking and herd mentality has an impact. So I'm really curious, after all that I've said, I'm really curious to kind of hear how you wrestled with that in either or both of those professions.
Yeah, I mean, in a former life, many, many years ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I was a police officer for about 3 years. Yeah. And, you know, there is, I don't really need to go into, you know, specific detail here about the way that the organization is structured. It is to be very much, I don't want to say groupthink, but it, you know, everything has to move in coordination. Everybody has to be on the same page for the most part. But there are forces, you know, within those relationships that obviously put pressure on you to behave in a way that may be outside of what is acceptable. I'm trying to be as delicate as possible here, but there's a lot of pressure there. I received a lot of pressure because I was, at the time, the only officer of Dominican heritage.
Yeah.
I'd say I'm American. I mean, I was born in America. I mean, I have a U.S. passport, and I can prove it. but I mean, I'm an American. I want to see the birth certificate. That's right. I do have a legitimate birth certificate that I can produce on demand. Anyway, but that is, honestly, I joke about that. That is what it felt like a lot of times, is prove that you are American and that you are one of us and that you are not separate from that. But like the scene in the movie Man of Steel, when Clark Kent was, or Superman was being pressured by the general, he says, "General, I grew up in Kansas, man. I can't be more American than that." but there was a lot of pressure to kind of prove that I was one of the guys. And so, you know, the idea that if a group of officers was doing one thing, you were expected to participate in that or to be a part of that in order to prove that you were part of the group. Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about that and you ask yourself, you know, when am I realizing here that I'm just going against the group, or I'm going with the group, or my own individual thinking, and what am I going to, and how am I going to deal with this situation? For me, many instances, there were times where I just had to think of I had to think to myself, honestly, is this going to land me in jail? This is not part of the policies and procedures that I learned in the academy. This is not part of that thing. And I'm going to get in trouble if I'm a part of this. And so that kind of helped, right? Knowing the policies and procedures, knowing what the law was, and also your own individual, your values and what your values are, right? So you have to think about that. But yeah. And then there were times when, you know, you heard a stick snap, and the herd ran one way, and I was right along with them, just running, and just until you kind of figure out what is going on.
One of the things, man, there's a lot of YouTube videos out here now with, you know, police footage, and everybody has a camera and they're recording police interactions. I remember I saw a situation recently where there was a sergeant, or, you know, there's a ranked official officer who was roughing up a guy who was in the car. And a small female officer came into this 6 foot plus guy and, you know, kind of pulled his arm, was like, "Man, you know, hey, give this, he's in cuffs, he's in the car, you know, give him a break." And he turned around and just grabbed her by the throat and pushed her up against the other police car while holding her by her throat. And I was surprised because, one, she was an officer herself, and none of the other officers that were standing there, you know, actually spoke up or stood up and said, hey, man, you know, don't put your hands. And I was thinking to myself, I am more than positive that, you know, take away the guns, take away the badges. The other male officers who were there have probably throughout their lives stood up for a female who was being mistreated. I wouldn't be surprised at that at all, whether it was their sister or whether it was just some girl at the school and somebody was bullying, you know, whatever it may be. You know, it's kind of like instinctive that, hey, I'm not supposed to just sit there and let some guy rough up a girl. And so I'm thinking about when we talk about that herd mentality, when we talk about groupthink or the togetherness forces, you know, how that plays in and how you experienced that or saw things. I know you don't want to get into specifics, but what you may have seen or
let's use the example that you're offering here. Okay.
Did you see that video?
I haven't seen the video, but I'll just send it to me. I can check it out. You know, here you have a leader that is committing this act, this behavior, where they are roughing up someone who's already in custody, and then a lower ranking officer tries to intervene, and the leader now is the one who is kind of directing the group in a sense, and the group is, as opposed, so in this instance, the leader is not being influenced by the group. The leader is influencing the group and causing this kind of groupthink situation here. The simple issue with this is what are the laws and the policies and procedures around handling a prisoner while they are in custody? Yeah. Once you violate that, anybody is within their right to address that. The problem is nobody wants to get in trouble. No one wants to be viewed as a rat. This is where the pressure comes in. So that female officer, whether she was a female or male, regardless of that, her actions have potentially branded her as a person that officers will look at when she shows up to the scene. They will kind of ostracize her or push her out and say, you know, you can't do anything with her around or with this officer around because they're going to rat you out or they're going to step in or they're going to make you look bad. And we need more people like that. That's what we need. I mean, it's for the betterment and the good of all, for the citizen, for the sergeant, and for everybody around, for someone to step in and say, hey, this is against our policies and procedures. You shouldn't be doing this. So let's just stop. And I've been in many situations where that has happened on both ends. You know, sometimes a situation gets so out of control, you lose yourself and you need someone to pull you back. And I've had that happen to me. And I've been on the other end of that where I've pulled people back and said, hey, let's regroup here. It's done. It's over. Guys in custody. You know, here's a really exist. What do you do when someone spits in your face? You know, even when they're handcuffed, I've had this happen to me. I've seen it happen to other people. Someone is handcuffed. They spit in your face. You know, the knee jerk reaction with that, or someone kicks you or they headbutt you but they're in custody, but they're still able to somehow get to a position where they can
get another lick in.
Yeah, exactly. So this is I've dealt with people who have been on a cocktail of drugs that make them stronger than any human being I've ever encountered, to where I was even worried that they would break the handcuffs, these individuals. So even while they're in handcuffs, you're doing it. But, you know, at some point you need that value check and you need to ask yourself, hey, is this within policy? And it's a hard thing. It's dynamic. So a lot of times we see the event after it happens. I'm not here to judge or to vindicate police officers' actions, because a lot of times we don't know what has happened. But it does, you know, let's say just for hypothetically speaking, let's say that person did do something to that sergeant that got them out of control. Okay, I think we all can almost forgive his knee-jerk reaction. I think we can all give some space to that and say, hey, you know, he spat in the sergeant's face or did something and his knee-jerk reaction was to rough him up a little bit. But once the other officer intervenes, I think that's when we say, hey, look, you had your chance. You had a person to intervene. But then to go the steps forward and assault that officer and for the other officer standing around. I mean, half of the things that happen in law enforcement could be fixed if people just stood up and said, don't do that. Go ahead.
I just want to say, I think that is, you kind of hit on it a moment ago. When we talk about leadership, then the leadership is not necessarily, even though we're talking to positional leaders, you know, that's what Unbox to Lead is about. We work with positional leaders, C-suite officers, executive directors, vice presidents, and things of that nature, presidents. But the real leadership is not necessarily the individual that holds the title, but the individual that is willing to step up and to bring the situation into a right place, for lack of a better term. I'm getting a brain freeze, but to get it into the right place, that's the leader. It's not the person that's called sergeant or lieutenant or captain. It is the person who actually does what is necessary to bring about the proper resolution or to bring about the proper movement of the organization. And so I think this is one of the reasons why it is so important for the person with the title to be intentional to move the organization in the right direction and to create a culture. Another shameless plug, you know, that's one of the things we talk about a lot at Unbox to Lead, and we really work with leaders on, is how to develop that type of culture. Because, and I want to go back to, you know, your experience. I know you had two experiences, but since we're on policing, we'll stick with it. You know, how much did you notice culture having a strong sway? And I'm going to come back to culture, another aspect of culture in just a little bit. But how much did you experience culture having such a determinant over how people exercised individuality versus the togetherness forces?
And that's a good question. And when you say culture, you mean the culture, the organizational culture, or are you talking about organizational culture?
Oh, it could be just the culture. You know, when those guys in Mississippi, it was police officers and civilians joined together in the 1960s that killed those, you know, civil rights activists. So that was culture. It was just organizational culture. It was
culture. So organizational culture. Organizationally, the department that I worked for was very clear that police brutality, unjustifiable shootings, and all of this stuff was not tolerated. It's still very difficult, as we know, to convict a police officer for these things. But it was clear that was not tolerated. Now, maybe the challenge was the disciplinary matters. Now, I had faced discipline, and I've known other officers that have faced discipline for their actions. That structure is all there. I think the problem is the organizational culture does speak in one strong united voice. These behaviors are not tolerated. Every time I see a unjustifiable police shooting, on the news, and I see the kind of the circumstances from the view that I'm able to see, I always say that it's just, that's not how I was trained. So I don't know how the officers even got into that situation. That was just not how I was trained. I've been in situations where I probably could have discharged my firearm. I probably would have been justified to do it. So I don't understand how there are situations where, someone gets shot in the back 9 times as they're running away. Like that always baffles me. So the organizational culture is very clear as far as how they expect their officers to behave and how they expect them to interact with the citizens and within the ranks. I think what happens is that bumps up against the culture. You have one majority group that is doing the enforcement, and then you have another group that is having the enforcement acted upon them, and and that culture will clash because sometimes an officer may show up to a scene. An officer who is Caucasian may show up to an African American household or a Hispanic household, where we generally tend to just be loud, even when we're just talking normal. We're just having to be loud. We can be talking about the greatest thing in the world, and it sound like a knockdown, dragout fight. I mean,
as our audience is seeing right now, you have an African American and a Latino, and we're just loud. We have to turn down the.
Oh, well, we're doing everything we can to keep this tamp down. I mean, when the camera goes off, it's a completely different experience. I think that's a whole different experience. But I think when you bump up against that and you don't understand, the difference in culture, you tend to bring a sense of, you don't really understand the culture enough, and so you kind of escalate things. But I don't want to go down that road because I don't think that's what our conversation is. I do want to make this point about my experience with groupthink and the dynamic, the extremes in law enforcement. Yes, I was subject to a lot of groupthink. That was a challenge where I did care a lot about what the group and what my fellow officers thought about me. And it did have an influence on a lot of my behaviors. When I moved into the corporate world, however, I kind of swung to the complete extreme of that, to where I just didn't really care what anybody thought. I was going to do what I was going to do the way I was going to do it, based on my values and so I was instantly comfortable with pushing back. I think probably too, with my experience in law enforcement with dealing with conflict, I was much more comfortable dealing with conflict than people in the corporate space when I got into that. I had no problem with conflict.
How much of your comfortableness in the corporate world do you think was a reaction to your experience in law enforcement?
Well, that's what I mean. As a police officer, I was dealing with conflict all the time. So I became very comfortable with that. I became just like, even in my household, when one of our kids gets sick or, something happens, my wife tends to have she might have a much more extreme reaction than I would. Well, that's because I've seen the absolute worst. And so when it doesn't approach that, I tend to not freak out. I just act and do whatever it needs to do. So, I've seen the end of the line for people. So, when my kids are sick, I'm realizing, well, they got a long way to go for that. So I don't freak out. So that being said, when there's a relationship issue in a corporate setting, I've never had a problem kind of being direct and getting involved in having a conversation, or if, you know, the manager in the room or the supervisor or even the CEO presents an idea, I've never had a problem with saying, I think we should rethink that, or tell me more about that, or let's better understand that. Because what I'm seeing is, and everyone is looking around at me like, what are you doing opening your mouth? You know, the CEO has said this, and I'm saying, yeah, but the CEO wants to run out in the street on a busy highway. And I'm telling him, hold on, wait a minute. Don't do that. But they're all saying, let him run out there on the street. That's his prerogative. That's what he wants to do. And we'll all follow him. And I'm saying, no, we don't do that. So my experience in dealing with conflict as a law enforcement in law enforcement made it, you know, and that was a challenge. I had to recorrect and realize, hey, people aren't comfortable with conflict, or they're not comfortable with pushback at times. And when you see that the herd is running one way, that was always a challenge for me. Okay, well, am I going to be the only, you know, water buffalo or wildebeest that says, no, let's stay at the watering hole. There's no need to run. It wasn't a crocodile. You know, it was just the wind blowing. You know, I want to drink some more. It's hot out there. You know, we can all drink. What do I do when everybody's run off? Do I run with them, or do I stay, you know, with my, you know?
So it seems like, and this is a perfect segue for us to go into the specifics of our broadcast today. But it seems like your experience in law enforcement had a significant influence on how you functioned in the corporate world, how you functioned even in your consulting business, and even in the relationship that we have right now of Unboxed Lead. And the reason I think this is a good transition is because I want to talk about the three characteristics that authentic leaders have when they're trying to manage the togetherness forces. And what you just shared a moment ago was about how law enforcement, again, influenced. And so here's the first characteristic of authentic leaders. And here it is. Authentic leaders are more aware of what influences their current thinking. And I'm gonna put that slide up on the screen right now. There's three characteristics. And the first one is authentic leaders are more aware of what influences their current thinking. And I wanna talk about this for a moment, because if we don't know, and I shared this a little while ago, if we're not sure of why we think the way that we think, then we're just going to end up, again, going with either what we've always done or just going along with the crowd. So when we understand, okay, I am thinking it, and I don't know how much intentionality you put into your thinking in the corporate world, if it was just something that was comfortable, or did you recognize, I feel comfortable pushing back, speaking my mind, giving my opinions because I had those experiences at law enforcement, or if it's just something that just happened. But what I'm encouraging and what is necessary is that even when you are making a wise decision, the more intentional that you can be at making those decisions, and we can take that slide down now, at making those decisions, then the more, you know, the more clear rather that you can be as to why you're making those decisions, even if it's a good decision, then the more you're likely to make otherwise decisions. So what I mean by that is the more a leader becomes clear about what influences them, the easier it becomes for them to become clear about what they actually want to be. So what influences your thinking about race? You know, as I shared before, one of the things that I do when I do training around race and things of that nature and explicit bias is I ask people, write out everything that you can think about that you learn from television, from your family, from school, from society, from books, from the media, wherever it may be, about Blacks, Black Americans. What did you learn about Asians? What did you learn about, you know, Latinos, Hispanics, as we used to call them, et cetera? What did you learn? So that the clearer you could become, you know what? The images that I saw, every time I turned on the television, I saw Black people, you know, talking jive and pimping and walking around being slick. Chased by the police, involved in criminal activity. You know, that's what I learned. I saw black women as being loud and you know, always wanting to be fighting, sassy, et cetera. This is what I saw. So, you know, you ask yourself the question, what did I learn about race? What did I learn about sex? What did I learn about nationalism? You know, what influenced my thinking about management and leadership? You know, when we bring leaders on, we always ask, you know, what influenced you? Who influenced you? How did you come to this place of your leadership philosophy? Because it's so important to be able to trace that. Because if we're unclear about how we arrived at our beliefs or thinking, then ultimately we will operate more on autopilot than on intentionality. And again, great leaders are intentional. I know I've been doing a lot of talking, but I do want to share one more thing with you. It's another slide. And that slide says, we also know that for both humans and other forms of life under stress, the natural urge is to go along with the social group. The natural urge to go along with the social group decreases the ability of individuals to accurately gauge the reality of the situation. Let me read that again. We also know that for both humans and other forms of life under stress, the natural urge to go along with the social group decreases our ability to accurately gauge the reality of the situation. Reality becomes a social reality under pressure. Man, reality becomes a social reality under pressure. In other words, leadership has to be authentic. Leadership has to be intentional, or authentic leadership rather has to be intentional. And I really encourage leaders to not just focus on what you want to believe, but also focus on what you have always been taught to believe. You know, you and I had a conversation off screen, Raphael, about being Dominican, but not being from the Dominican culture and kind of living in that world. I'm just going to throw that out there. I wanted you to kind of talk on that. I shared that with you earlier. I wanted to kind of hear your thinking on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those the context of our conversation was the influence of culture on us as people. Like I think you were saying earlier that we, in culturally speaking, we never even get a chance to choose as individuals what food we like, what music we like. Like that is just kind of imprinted upon us from the day that we're born. We just, yeah. whatever our culture dictates and demands that we eat and like whatever the cultural norms are, we just roll with that. That becomes normal for us. I think the challenge is with me as a child of immigrants. I think anyone can relate to this whose parents are from, you know, whatever their original country, and they come here and you assimilate and you become an American, right? That's all I know. But you are separated from the broader culture from which your parents' heritage is. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and there was, I think we were the only Dominican family there for, as far as I remember, for a long time. Yeah. My family came in the 60s. And, you know, that was it. They learned English immediately. And then what they realized that not being, had they moved to New York, it would have been a completely different experience. But growing up in Kansas City, you know, I had to learn English was the language. That was it, because no one else was speaking Spanish around at that time. So when I became an adult, but I grew up, my grandmother, you know, she made Dominican food. So I was used to that. I had listened to merengue, bachata, and all of these kinds of things. And I'd listened to, you know, Spanish being spoken. So there was a little bit of a connection there. But it wasn't a full connection. I wasn't raised Dominican. So whenever I would hang out, or when I became an adult and I, you know, became friends with other real Dominicans per se, it was like, man, I might as well have just been the biggest gringo out there. I mean, you know, I could kind of keep up. I could relate. I could feel. It felt familiar. It felt comfortable. But it just, you know, there's just a whole difference. I mean, everyone that I met that was Dominican were basically the same person for the most part. The same person. The way that the inflection in their Spanish. That, I mean, they were individuals, but as a group, you know, they were just one life form. And if I popped into that group, man, I mean, I stood out like a sore thumb. I didn't have to open my mouth. It was just clear the way I walk, you know, the clothes that I wear, the way that I even stand up and lean against the wall. There's nothing cool about it. That's the one thing about Dominicans, man. They are,
yeah, they are
a
cool,
cool group of people, man. Yeah, I mean, they man. Are. They are. I mean, that is like that is one thing cool. I always say you're born with that. You know, my wife is a very cool person, and she just exudes cool. And I'm like, you just can't fake that. You either are or you aren't. And I missed that part culturally growing. I didn't get the language, I didn't get the food, and I didn't get the coolness.
You just brought up something. You're right. We did have this conversation earlier.
Unbox provides a full service leaders peer support community that helps high level leaders become more authentic leaders who build healthy workplace cultures and reach their personal life goals. To learn more and discover how we can take your leadership and your life to the next level, please visit our website at unboxtolead.com. That's unboxed, the number two, lead.com. Again, that's unboxed, the number two, to lead.com.